Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Lee Arkinall.
Thanks for joining everyone.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of April 15th, 2024. So I was going to kick off with a NIST publication, actually. They have a new publication that they just pushed out this month for review, and it's called the Incident Response Recommendations and Considerations. So they're looking for feedback, but I always kind of like these publications. I wish I had more time, because one of those daunting tasks when you see publications like this and guidance is they're always really long documents, like, you know, close to 50 plus pages usually. But there's always really good information. And, you know, I always like when I have the time to go through the exercise of saying, well, here's what I have from documentation from my company, my operation, my whatever. And I always like just to compare, contrast, to see how much am I really covering down on that's similar, what's different, you know, because that really starts to formulate ideas for, hey, if we were to actually, try to foster some change, what changes should I care about the most? And one of the things I thought they did really well, at least with this initial publication for review, they have what they call the preparation table. And within it, they have two categories, or two columns, I should say. And one is more of about they score things a high, medium, and low. High meaning these functions are core to incident response for most organizations. Medium being directly supports incident response for most organizations, and low indirectly supports for most organizations. So you can kind of get a feeling for how should I be looking at these activities as far as are they directly tied to, or are they kind of more supportive in nature based on kind of the community of how organizations typically handle that. And then the other column they have this scoring of, or they have, you call it like comments, but basically they're scored by an R, C, or N, depending on, you know, as they listen, like R1, R2 kind of thing. But R is really for the recommendations for things organizations should do, right? So when you see certain rows with that in there, those are ones that really highlight on, these are ones I should really be comparing to what I am doing today. C was considerations, so something you should consider doing. So this is kind of a way to go above and beyond, or might cater to more your risks or your scenarios that you've dealt with. And then they have an N for just basically additional information that's besides any kind of recommendations or considerations, which is kind of nice, because sometimes you might look at recommendations or look at the bullet points and try to decipher, well, why is this really important? I think the note section really helps with that. And every single row, as they basically talk through incident response, they map it directly to the CSF, cybersecurity framework that NIST has. So that identify, protect, detect, respond, and recover, which I thought was, you know, a really good way to say, okay, if we're already trying to follow NIST based on our incident response plans and things we do, how does that line up and where do we focus our efforts? So I think these documentations are really good. I really wish there was a way. I actually know some people that have done exercises like this in the past, but taking this information and trying to put it into a centralized database that has, you know, everyone else's versions of plans and recommendations and things, and see kind of what overlaps, what's uniquely different and things like that. Because I think there's a lot of value to there, especially when you need to map things and other types of platforms for management, how you deal with risks and things. So just a big formal documentation. I wasn't going to walk through the whole document, because like I said, they're really long. But yeah, Lee, what are your thoughts when you see things like this?
So funny enough, talking about the length of it, I mean, I think this one was 40 pages long. And I don't know when they start doing this, or it's just been a while since I looked at one of these, but they start numbering the lines too. So it's like 545.
I think that's because it's up for review. So they can, like, if you were to tell them, hey, on line 434, there's an issue. I think it's not, gets fully published, I think they remove it. Yeah.
Okay. And I think my eyes were drawn to the same thing. Because the whole description, reading the roles and in place and everything, giving the whole, like, preparation of, like, this is what we're getting into. And then, like, table two, the one you mentioned, you know, community profile for incident response and core one preparation. So this is where people should look at and judge, or organizations should look at and see, you know, what are they recommending? Where am I at today? Now,
right.
I might be reading this wrong. I don't know if I'm just going to say it. I may be wrong, or people can tell me wrong, but something struck me right away. So the first few rows of the table itself is talking about the govern element and the element description being the organization's cybersecurity risk management strategy, expectations, and policies are established, communicated, and monitored. The circumstances, mission stakeholders, expectations, dependencies, and legal regulatory surrounding the organization's cybersecurity risk management decisions are understood. Then the mission is understood, and stakeholders are understood. So all you have all these things that, and I get it's governance, but they gave the low priority. Now, I get that for the missions, for actually conducting incident response, if those things aren't completely understood, and I'm not talking about like at a technical level, but the mission statement isn't understood by governance.
Well, so I like that you point that out, but it really low means it just indirectly supports. So it wouldn't be directly towards the actions of incident response. And I think they should really consider maybe using different language between high, medium, and low. Because I think they're trying to qualify that it's low because it's not what instant responders will be doing. And so they should almost break it out on like what is, I don't know why they didn't use like directly support, indirectly support, yeah, critical or something like that, right?
I was going to say, because that's what, like, if your organization doesn't understand what incident response is, what the mission is, then how are they going to support you whenever it comes to, hey, management's trying to do this to improve the roles, or we need another person, or, you know, we need these certain things. If the stakeholders aren't buying into it, then how are you going to get that long-term support financially and, what, you know, even from a managerial perspective? I think that's how I was reading into it. You bring a little bit of a good point. Directly related would probably be better verbiage. I think I was just kind of shocked by it. But yes, I know governance isn't in there doing the incident response with you, but you still need that whole organizational support that, yes, we are doing incident response in here as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you've probably been involved, but when an incident comes up, you know, you've got your security team is interacting with other parts of the business, and if there's not executive or upper management support, you'll just get blown off half the time. There'll be no reasoning for them to be like, oh, I need to drop what I'm doing and help these people, right? So,
right, yeah. But that I think that was my big takeaway. Of course, it's a lot of good information here, a lot of good information here. That I think that was just my biggest, I guess, note.
Did I hear it? Well, cool. Yeah, I didn't have anything else that, you know, I just want to kind of bring this up so that people have a chance to look at it. And then, you know, maybe glean some things from it. Or if they actually have really good input, maybe they can respond directly to this for updates or call for updates. So yeah, we can move on to what you got prepared for us.
I'm kind of bummed you didn't read the whole thing to us. I was looking for holy story hour.
We're going to come out with the audio book after this where I just read NIST reports and you could subscribe. But
all right, so first up, I have an article from Trend Micro titled Cyber Espionage Group, Earth Hundens, and I hope I said that correctly, Continuous Refinement of Water Bear and Deuter Bear. Hope I said that correctly too. But it was interesting because I actually got this from I believe it was Cyber hold on, cybersecurity news site itself, which actually led me here. Was it that? Or was it another? Yeah, no, it was. But going through, the first thing that stuck out was talked about sophistication. And I hate to say that I kind of roll my eyes sometimes whenever we hear it was a sophisticated cyber attack, because we've heard that before. Then it's, and I think it might just be a knee-jerk reaction sometimes where people are like, it was a huge organization. They must have been, state-sponsored, so it must have been sophisticated.
Right.
After the evidence is revealed, they're like, oh, no, it was the script kiddie. And there was a, public-facing, vulnerable machine, right? That's not a lot about sophistication. This, on the other hand, seems very, very well orchestrated. And to give you some highlights about what I'm talking about, is that Earth Hunden is, like the title suggests, is focused on cyber espionage. So their goal is to remain hidden in the environment as long as possible. So they're being very careful about what they do. Not only what they do, but the tools that they're using. And not only malware, but like C2 infrastructure and so on. They're doing a lot of defense evasion, because they don't want to get caught. So they're going to add those techniques into it, where they're looking at anti-sandbox, anti-debug, and the main tactics that are out there and published. But what they've been doing, and not saying that part isn't sophisticated, but the part that truly speaks to the sophistication is that they're using a piece of malware that has been updated since 2009 about 10 times. And why I found that interesting is that it's not just changed, like, in my mind, that tells me that the hashes just hasn't changed. Like, it wasn't like, oh, we got caught, so let's modify the code in a way that will modify the hash so we can get through those, through those security tools. They mentioned that it was being updated with like more capabilities, which shows that they are using something that is keeping up with the landscape of defenders and their capabilities. And then whenever they gain persistence, they used DLL side loading, which is a technique that is very common as well. But what they mentioned in the article is that they used a legitimate executable that is patched and designed to call this or load this custom DLL. They modified the import table so that they could actually have the DLL or at ordinal zero. Now, that's what the report says that, and I was like, okay, I think I have an idea of what this means, but I'm going to double check and let me dig in some research. So in the past, in articles that I've read, in malware that I've detonated, in the lab, and even malware I've created, I haven't, MS Venom has, but I've had to figure out, when I execute a DLL, how do I get the instructions to get called? And normally, because I use Metasploit, I've had to use the pound sign or the hashtag and point to a location that I want. And the articles that I've read, there's always been like #1 or # something in the command line arguments, where it says run DLL32, then it calls the DLL, then there's a comma, and then it's like #1. I figured that's what the ordinal was, because it's telling the DLL where to start extracting its instructions. And I was like, what does ordinal zero mean? Why is that significant? And basically, and what I've read up, and I hope this is what my understanding is, I hope it's correct, is that now if the legitimate executable calls the DLL, they don't have to signify, or they don't have to use that pound sign, which, if you think about EDRs, if you think about hunt packages, if you think about detection engineering, all these, the normal type of sideloading always deals with pointing to the entry point of the DLL or to like a different ordinal. Whereas if you have all that protection that already exists already and you create a program that doesn't have to do that, how many rules are you going to bypass? There's also the program, because it's legitimate, has a legitimate name. They use the same name of the program for the DLL, so it looks even more legitimate. And then you get this lack of activity from the command line argument. So it could just be calling the DLL that looks exactly like the same, with no other indicators that something might be malicious or happening. Which, that small tweak and that extra effort that they put in, I mean, I hate to sound like I'm impressed, but I really am, because thinking about...
thought into it for sure, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why I would say sophisticated, because it's not just your run-of-the-mill, here's how we're going to do it, let's go in, smash and grab, let's hope it works. This is a, what are the defenders doing right now that are getting other people caught? What articles are they publishing and so on? How can we get around that? And it was just like, wow. Like the fact that they just use that for persistence, a legitimate executable, just, I don't know. It floored me, I guess. But I hate to sound like I'm gushing, but this was truly one time that it was like, they put a lot of thought into it and I was impressed. But enough about me. What were your thoughts?
So yeah, the first thing that stood out to me was the patched for DLL sideloading, because it's very common for DLL sideloading is a great technique to bypass a lot of things. But a lot of actors just go find older third-party executables that are just vulnerable to this. And it's pretty easy if you just have the right tools to analyze a file to see if it's vulnerable based on how it looks for the DLLs to load. But obviously, they took it a step further. Like you mentioned, they patched it so that they had a better success with running. The one thing I didn't see, I didn't look too hard, but you know, when you patch an executable that may be legitimate, then you're also invalidating the signature, I'd assume. So this probably becomes unsigned at that point, or maybe the signature's not valid, but a lot of things don't check for if the signature's valid, so that might not be a concern. But that's why signatures are so important, is to kind of prevent some of the tampering of files, right? But one of the things that I like about these types of reports, and they have a nice table at the bottom that's a comparison between the water bear versus the deuter bear. And they kind of show how it's kind of matured and some of the thoughts that went into certain things, which I think is really important, because then you kind of understand what kind of capabilities are adversaries, what do they care about? And how are they trying to beat defenses? That's what I get from these. Like, there's not a lot of information that I would turn into, like, how would I threat hunt for this from some of these reports, because they get into more, like, how is the malware coded, and not so much how it specifically would look like running in an environment. Other than they kind of talk through some of the network packet information. But the comparison, you can see where they show the maturity where, you know, like, for instance, the CNC string decryption, you know, the newer version is XORing with a 16-byte key versus originally it was just an XOR of a single byte of FF, all ones. So greatly changed on how they can control how they're decrypting the CNC. They did add encryption for the communication. It was just over HTTP, but now it's HTTPS. Where they generated their RC4 key when they are downloading traffic. It used to be generated on the victim machine, which would then be susceptible for, you know, some reverse engineering and figuring some things out. They actually now started generating the key on the server side, so they have more control over that. And then the encrypted downloaded path for the earlier version, they had a file and a registry where they're like leveraging two different places. This actually looked for just using registry for the newer version. So you can kind of see how things have matured based on things they've learned along the way. Also looking at, you know, how threats are being caught, like you said, I think that's a great call out. So I think it's really important for defenders to look at this. I think these are really valuable reports if you're a malware reverse engineer person or you're a malware author. There's a lot of things you kind of like learn, like, oh, this is interesting. I wonder if I can make this work. So there's those advantages. And I think of that too. You know, for instance, when you go and you learn about encryption, Sometimes it's not really important to know how the math works in an encryption to be able to leverage encryption well and implement it. That's more important. So when it comes to these reports, trying to glean the how to use this data is a little harder, but it's always really informative as far as where is the headspace of the adversary and the person's building tool sets. Like I said, getting back to what do they care about, based on what they can run and access by having this malware in your environment, kind of helps drive to now what are their real motives, and then how do you set up the right defenses so that you will see activity when they then try to grab something, move something, change something, because those things will be picked up in your environment, not so much the malware itself if they're really good at designing it. So yeah, those are just kind of like my top level thoughts on seeing this. It's really cool to see the overtime comparison. I really like that the most, just because it shows what a dedicated, well-crafted group would do. It's not just a, hey, we have something that works and we just use it until it doesn't work. It's more like, no, our job is to literally be effective. In order to be effective, we're always creating, always changing, always, figuring out better and different ways to get at our mark. So, yeah, cool.
Was a good report. And unfortunately, that could call at the end that we're not the only ones improving. And they're paying attention to, they're going back to the drawing board with their malware. And yeah. But what you got next for us?
Yeah, so the next one is kind of a really quick thing. And it was really just because I was thinking more about how we're seeing it, and it's about DLL sideloading. But it was a simple report, more newsworthy with some references to some technical stuff from the cyberexpress.com, but it's called the, I guess you'd say, Fatal Rat Targets Cryptocurrency Users with DLL Sideloading Techniques. And they basically show that, you're going to download some sort of application that's Trojanized. So you'll get the legitimate application when it unpacks, but it also unpacks two other legitimate executables that are really just vulnerable to sideloading. And then they have the corresponding malicious DLLs that get unpacked with them. The executables, I'm not familiar with them, but thelp.exe and tries.exe, I don't know if they're renamed or that's the legitimate name of the actual executable when it was created. And it got me thinking, if you're in a large environment and you have the right visibility, and we talk about kind of like discovery or profiling, your environment in general, you should be able to hopefully have an inventory of executables across your environment, as far as either you can scrape across different log sources. But I even remember, in our past life, we even had our software management tools would actually do the crawl for us and give us an inventory, because that was how they'd manage, is there any like third-party software that we don't know about that we need to somehow either remove or patch because it's adding a vulnerability, that kind of thing. Because with the DLL sideloading, a lot of times there are just legitimate programs that are being pulled down to be exploited essentially as part of these techniques. And the amount will be very low. So if you were able to just inventory based on name and obviously have location is really important, and then just sort by what's rarer, for an EXE, for instance, a lot of these would sift right to the top, and you'd say, well, we have a really weird, we've got a thelp.exe. We don't see on anyone else's machine. It's on this one machine and it happens to be in their download directory folder. Like, that's questionable. And then if you're able to somehow tie that there's DLLs associated at the same, creation time, even more telling, right, potentially. So if you're able to actually inventory when those files are created, that's why Sysmonitor thinks great, because you can basically specify create logs for different file extensions. But in some cases, let's be honest, actors are smart enough to not include the DLL on the files because you don't necessarily need it. Well, actually, maybe in this case you would, because it would be specifically looking for that specific file to load in, and it's using the file name, not necessarily what's in the file, to trick it to actually load the wrong thing. So maybe you would need an extension in that in this specific scenario. But it's really just about looking at how to try to solve this problem with data you potentially have. Because I don't know, I feel like almost weekly, we have a specific attack that we talk through or gets reported on where DLL sideloading is just part of it. In a lot of cases, it's not like a unique, like someone created their own executable to then do DLL sideload. They're always just using some known legitimate things that they know work in the past or discovered and use them in their attack that really have no other purpose other than helping them load their code. Yeah, just trying to think about ways to solve that. And, you know, if you've got the visibility and the data, I think it's definitely doable, at least to get to uncover and hunt for these types of things for sure. So what are your thoughts?
So I was actually shocked by the amount of DLL sideloading that was involved. Like, it was, it's like, and then more DLL sideloading and more DLL. I was like, wow, okay.
I think because EDRs are so popular, and I think DLL sideloading is one of the things that gets past EDR maybe the most, because they do kind of know about the legitimate software, and it's a little harder to determine if the DLL is malicious. So maybe that's why it's more prevalent, but I don't know. It's just a hunch.
That may be. I'm right there with you. The fact that there were, I mean, because like you said, the DLL sideloading, it loaded the TLT help, which was the clipper or their keylogger. Reading through the report, I wasn't shocked by the target audience that it was going for. That once again, they're targeting crypto wallets, because I have a feeling, and this, I'm not meaning this as a political rant at all, but if the government would start to regulate cryptocurrencies, I have a feeling that this might take a back burner for a while, because if that happens, then, you know, then there might be some more restrictions in place or some controls or some better regulation about it, which I'm not vouching for at all. Don't think I'm taking that stand. Just the thought process, because I compared it to like banks, right? Like, what does someone have to do to hack into a bank or into an organization, then get to a bank if they want, you know, that type of stuff? Like Lazarus Group come to mind, seeing what they've done in the past. This is kind of still that low hanging fruit, because it's like a crypto, the crypto splurge where people are, you know, they're still buying a bunch of crypto. A lot of people are investing a lot of money into it, with security not always at the forefront. Crypto rant off. But the fact that it loaded all these different keyloggers and looked for all this information, based on the target that they were looking for. You know, they're collecting browser information, they're collecting clipboard information. They were also trying to figure out what kind of environment are they on. So once again, a defensive agent. So if there were some VMware services running, they would definitely stop, because they're like, well, this isn't really what we're looking for. I did like I thought it was neat that in the code that they shared, the code snippets, that the remote server's name was encoded in reverse. So if you did see that, once again, just a neat little thing. It was insane to see how many different reasons they were employing DLL sideloading. But another great article, another great, the information they shared, the screenshots they shared, they all add value to the report, which is very appreciated. We appreciate that.
Cool. Yeah, that's all I got really there. I just want to highlight on just like looking at DLL sideloading yet again. So what do you got next?
So I have an article.
I like some
of that. You're finishing, right?
No, this is like my one. When you found this article, I've been looking for a really good write up on this specifically alone for a while, and I just kind of gave up. But you nailed it. So
that's a perk. We're in the same boat. As you know, and I'm sure if you follow me on LinkedIn or seen me talk or any podcast whatsoever. I always like to talk about Windows stuff because I'm very comfortable with Windows, and that's where I spend the majority of my time. Linux doesn't scare me. It's just that whole process of going through and learning a whole other operating system that, yeah, it is it best for me. But at this point, I think this is the article that is kind of forcing me into that field in a very happy way, though, because I've been wanting to do it. But reading through this, and it's called Linux Detection Engineering with Audit D from Elastic Security Labs. I discovered Audit D back in the day, back when I was working in the SOC. We actually had another analyst that was having a lot of fun with helping me set it up, because back in those days, Linux scared me even more. And he was like, "Yeah, let me set it up. Let's get some logs going." And we realized how noisy it could be. And it kind of stopped there, especially with the Sysmon rollout that I was conducting at the same time. But this article really sits back and introduces you into what Audit D is. And it's a tool designed for monitoring and recording system events to provide a comprehensive audit trail of user activities, system changes, and security access. Now, what I think I read into this was that this is kind of like, or it's closer to EDR logging than the normal Linux logging that exists. So this is more in depth, and the type of information that I want to look at, like processes being run, and so on. And it breaks it down to the control type rules of what you can do, what the parameters mean. Looking at file systems, so you can look at different things. It's system calls. So when you're looking at, or whenever you're looking for that information of what is being read, what is used to configure the audit, now rather than specifying the events, looking for all these different things that exist, like filters include task, entry, exit, user, exclude. Like you can do all these things that, and I could be wrong here, but reading about it and how to manage this, it sounds a lot like Sysmon and how Sysmon has a configuration file, how you can go in there and set the events to do what you want to do. And it's great because it's visual for me, which I need a lot of the times. It gives you examples of how to set it up. And then if this is new to an organization or to a person in general, they break it down into, or they provide some rules or detections that could find some things like potential reverse shell via UDP. So they don't give you the exact Audit D rule to use, unless I am reading, it looks like it's in Elastic, or maybe I am wrong. But they put it out there of, in looking at the different things that you're looking for. So the start, executed by what program, and so on. And then they continue to give you more and more different rules as well. And it's great because this, once again, this is what I was looking for and kind of hoping on all these days and years. And I finally found it. And whenever I do have free time, I'm going to finally dive into it. So from a person that is more well-versed in Linux than me, what value did you find out of here?
Well, one, just like the sheer explanation of kind of how to set it up, what are all the different controls and knobs you can do. They even talk about the Audit D Manager. So it makes it a little bit easier for how you configure, resolve things, and look at things, which I thought was a nice little capability. Right, for managing your agents and things like that. And then I'm surprised you didn't see it. It wasn't really called out well in there, but I just stumbled across it. So you know how Swift on Security and some of those have really good Sysmon like starting configurations? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Sorry, I was muted. So,
yeah, you're good. So they mentioned in there Neo23x0. He has a GitHub for what is a great place to start with a balance between visibility and performance that you would want from Audit D. Great, like, master file. He's got comments to describe everything he's doing. So he's got the things like, these are how you should, like, limit the noise here. Here's for looking at like some of the rules, looking at, I want to capture mount operations when, you know, different external things get mounted. Looking at how, when time gets adjusted, if it does, looking at all the different ways cron configurations and scheduled jobs run on the box. Looking at anything interacting with the user or group or password databases, anything that looks up the sudoers file. So, like, it's interesting. A lot of techniques, like from doing Hack the Box with friends and things in the past, you know, you get on like a box in Linux and you're trying to figure out how to, what you can get away with doing, what are some things you can interact with. A lot of the things he has in this main configuration, like audit.rules file, are things that you would do, like seeing who has sudo or access, or maybe there's certain things you don't need sudo to perform because you can see that. They talk about, you know, changing group identifiers, anything run from there. So what's nice is it's actually hitting on all the common things that people would leverage from the built-in utilities in Linux. And he's got rules designed for all that. So you will get the telemetry you would need, which is cool because I was thinking too, you know, now that Sysmon exists for Linux, Sysmon does a really good job capturing like execution type malicious actions and things like that for telemetry that you would want. And obviously Sysmon was originally built for Windows. So there's a little more things you can do with Sysmon on Windows than you can Linux, but for visibility sake, it's really a great place to be. But it kind of takes away some of that Linux skew as far as what's going on. And we've even mentioned in Windows, you still want some Windows logs to go along with Sysmon logs to really paint the picture, especially when you think about like authentication and things like that. Well, this is great because if you had these audit D rules and you had even Linux and Sysmon, you would have everything you need on a Linux system, to be able to walk back attacks or discover attacks. I would think very easily because there's certain things you wouldn't expect to actually occur. And it'd be easy just to kind of learn on those. So, yeah, I thought this was great. Like I've always, promoted audit D without really playing with audit D, because from people that I've talked to that have used it, they're kind of like, well, yeah, there's kind of a learning curve. And the article you found, I think, really addresses that, because, you know, looking at it from just a quick, you know, pass over, I feel very comfortable and confident that I know what I can do with it so that I can start actually playing with it and not worry about just trying to get it off the ground kind of thing. So very cool.
Yep, big shout out to Elastic for finally giving us what we've been searching for, or didn't know we were searching for all these years.
Yeah, no, it's great. And they just, yeah, that's right. It came out this month, so it's not, it hasn't been sitting there. We've missed it. It literally just came out.
Yeah, I would have been kind of embarrassed if I looked at the date and it was like years ago, like, oh, it's been around for a while.
Oh, I just failed to Google properly. Oh, that's too bad.
Right. I've been avoiding Linux that. All right.
Yeah, so the last one I want to touch on is something that kind of blew up recently. And I think Bilexity is one that authored it. But basically, and they're pretty good about picking up on zero-day exploitation as far as some of the reporting goes. But the thing they call out is the zero-day exploitation of unauthenticated remote code execution vulnerability in Global Protect, which is like the Palo product or firewall, VPN solution, whatever. It's CVE 2024-3400. And I thought this was interesting for a couple reasons. We've been looking at vulnerabilities and exploits in kind of a Linux environment in general. You know, we had the XZ stuff, I think that's what it was, that just got thrown out. And some others that kind of come up from time to time. And I'm always looking at, well, gosh, looking at the class of vulnerability, because I like to solve problems that way. Because if I were to say, how am I going to deal with this specific vulnerability, then I'll have to spend just as much energy and effort on the next vulnerability that comes out. But by understanding the class of vulnerability, understanding that what this vulnerability gives you is the ability to run and execute code. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have access. By executing code, you'd have to create access, right? So that means you have to figure out how to get some custom malware on the box, so that you can have the interactability, right? or you have to figure out how to get that box to call you in a certain way to open up that communication. So then you then can move to the next level of compromise, right? And by thinking through that dynamic and understanding enough, you know, just Linux in general, you know, there's a couple things that always seem to happen, right? When you look at anyone running things on Linux boxes, one is wget and curl usually almost always there on the box, right? So what is the best way to pull down a payload? Well, wget and curl. But one of the problems is if you, unless you want to exploit the box multiple times in order to download something and then go back in and execute or run code remotely from your exploit to then run whatever you downloaded, that could be hard and might not work as well. Well, with Linux, you can pipe things too, right? So you have the ability. So what they saw with people actually taking advantage of this vulnerability, as we have seen in historical things, they use wget and they downloaded a payload. Unique thing that we always say to look for, if wget or curl is calling directly to an IP, it's suspicious. It's worth looking into. But one of the things they did in order to get their payload to run, they did their remote code execution. And sometimes this is a caveat, right? We saw this with XZ, I believe, where there is a character limit. So you might not be able to put everything you want in one line. But they were able to pipe everything into a cron, so it's the /etc/cron.d /update, right? That's going to update cron, which is interesting because I've never actually updated cron that way. So kind of learn something new about how you can interact with cron to potentially get things to run in cron. And the cron job was a wget to grab their intended payload and pipe it to bash. So now you have, I'm going to pull down a payload and immediately run it, right? But when you pipe it to bash, what's uniquely different is if it's a bash script, you don't need to change the execution of that file. So what does that mean? One of the other unique things that's good to know about Linux is files that get moved to Linux natively do not have the ability to be executed unless their properties are changed to do so. That's where chmod comes in, chmod. And so when looking at any kind of exploitation on Linux, or not exploitation, anytime you see malicious files running on Linux, you commonly see chmod behavior activity going on. And it's also interesting when you see chmod making things that you wouldn't expect to be executable, like a JPEG or something, right? Like an image file. So those are weird characteristics there. The other thing, to note is, there are a few ways to make something executable on a Linux box without using chmod. So when you do your research on things, it's good to kind of understand what's the other side of it. If you compile something directly on a Linux box, the outcome can be a file that has the permissions to be executed, which is interesting because I always wondered why people compiled things locally when they got their code or whatever across. And I thought it was just so that it would have more success of running because it's compiled in an environment it's supposed to run in. Ironically, I think it also has maybe twofold, right? Now it's able to be executed. The other way is sometimes you have install scripts that is part of the install process. It makes something executable as well. But commonly, if you're just going to try to move a payload over and run it, you need to chmod it. So you're going to see that capability. So that's just from how did they get on the box, right? They actually had a Python backdoor they eventually pulled down called, they were dubbing Upstyle backdoor. But basically it gave them access, kind of talked through some of the capabilities that Upstyle had as far as interactability. But something to think about from an appliance perspective that is difficult, they're saying in this case, right, you got an appliance-like environment and you can't really see the underlying Linux OS stuff. So the things I described may not be as easily detectable. Molexity actually mentioned that you had to dump the logs like you would for a help support ticket. And then it would create a package dump and then you can crawl through that. But that isn't like a operationally very great way to monitor if you're being hit. Just knowing that this exists, now you're going to be pulling these logs and routinely looking at them until you can get patched. So that was something that was kind of, it sucks. I feel like appliances, if they have, OS-based logging or any logging underneath the hood, they should enable that logging to go somewhere from just a security best practice standpoint. But one of the things that they did once they had a foothold on the appliance was they were doing wget to timing services. So there are, you know, websites out there that have an API that you can say what time zone I am based on my IP kind of thing. And that's for a targeting specification, right? So I've seen this with the location data based on IP. I've seen where that was the first step attacker that they landed. Well, interesting enough, I don't know if it's the same attacker, but they changed something to slightly different where they're actually looking at time zone data based on IP lookup. So it's a kind of an interesting telling thing. One, if your appliance is making that call and it never does, but two, you know, that's not a common call I'd expect to be set up. So looking at those types of services and calls, especially via wget. And then the other thing that was interesting looking into this was if you're sitting on that, and that's your beachhead at this point, and you start seeing SMB and RDP connections to internal from your environment, kind of also a red flag, right? It's something that you should actually be aware of, or what's your subnets for external devices, or what are your subnets for your DNZ, and what kind of connections are trying to be made from those areas to internal. And RDP would be the hugely questionable unless that you have a specific purpose-built jump host or jump box where you expect that's how people are going to like remotely connect in and go to this box because it has some extra fluff as far as how it authenticates people to then jump into the environment. But understanding your environment, understanding those things, looking at that kind of behavior is really important. But they seem to have really targeted grabbing credentials in this type of attack. They wanted to, luckily they realized domain admin were sitting on some of these appliances as far as creds go, so that made it really easy. Maybe they needed domain admin because these can do policy-based enforcements, and that was their easy way to get access to the right Active Directory stuff they needed. You might not actually need domain admin to do that, so it's something to look at as far as how you provision things externally if they have these kind of vulnerabilities. But yeah, they were looking for creds, they're looking for DP API keys, which is kind of like the user-based encryption, but is more for like the domain backups for how Windows does default encryption for those things. So they can pull backups of things, and they're pulling the database backups or the domain backups to gather information, which is a common technique too. So it was kind of a really interesting attack that is very easily understood, but much harder to actually identify just because the visibility gaps that may exist either on your network architecture to be able to see the network things because you're sitting at the edge, right? So if something at your outermost edge, which is supposed to be at the outermost edge typically, is talking out, if it doesn't see itself talk out, you're not going to know. But hopefully you have enough visibility internally so when it talks in, you can see that, right? But also this visibility on the system itself, you know, you might not have the visibility you would need to see the most common activities that identify malicious and bad. So interesting attack, really good detail. They did a really good job. I'm sure there's going to be more to come. I'm actively looking into other things too on it. So, but yeah, I just figured we'd talk about it here because it's kind of breaking.
Yeah. So a couple of things that stand out about, I think I heard you mention multiple, but one, the quick turnaround of this article and the findings look great. Good to see that cybersecurity organizations still diving deep into these fires real quick and then trying to figure out what they can. So, I mean, what you said, the first attack was March 26th and it's April 15th, or was this reported on the 12th? Either way, they got some speed into it. So in-depth research, a lot of technical details, not just your random normal cybersecurity blurb of there was this happening and then nothing actual behind it. Looking through defense evasion, through deletion of logs, modifying timestamps, once again, not surprised to see that because it's not just a Windows thing that exists anywhere there are logs. The compromise of the highly privileged service account that was used for the Palo and what that got access to, I feel like if there was just some better controls behind what that thing can access, then maybe it would have maybe, you know, decreased the impact that the attack had. And I think that goes for, you know, any privileged accounts in any organization, that one of the things that you really want to make sure is that you have a good limitation on those highly privileged accounts. Like, yes, they are doing something special. They need to access some certain things, but give them only the access they need and hopefully not to the rest of your environment. So that if the adversary does compromise them, they still got to do some more work. And the concern of the lack of visibility of these logs, then I think I'm echoing other people's opinions as well. Whenever you know, our team was talking about what the big things that they're seeing, you know, if you have to generate a tech support file to get logs or visibility into the device you have, that's a huge problem. That's an immediate gap, especially. I mean, and I'm not saying we can build detections for 0 days for everything, but if you have at least the visibility into it, you can possibly catch the weird things that are happening. And then looking at the other section that said volatile memory collection, that you need assistance from Palo Alto as well. I don't know, the fact that in an emergency situation, you couldn't just do that yourself. It's handcuffing the incident responders in an incident response team of what they are capable of doing when a fire like this starts, and that it's tough to see. But those were the main things that really stuck out for me.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see what information comes to the surface, you know, soon after these types of attacks are disclosed. And, you know, the one thing I like is there's always something I have seen before, which is a good sign when it comes to why we hunt, because if we can see things that have happened before, that means those are things we potentially could hunt for in the future and have some success, right? So that I always like, because, you know, obviously if the 0 day being leveraged, you assume sophistication, but if they're also using behaviors that have been seen before that are just really known easy behaviors, it just shows that it doesn't matter how sophisticated you are, you can be hunted for.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, that's what I got for that one. So I think that kind of closes us out. So I really just want to thank everyone for joining us this week for our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. So with that, that closes out our top 5 threat hunting headlines for the week of April 15th, 2024.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.